May it please the court, my name is Liz Portomeo. My attorney registration number is 38447, and I'm here today on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. James Robert Stackhouse. Although there are four issues on appeal, my argument today will focus on that first issue, the right to public trial issue. I will stand on the brief submitted on the remaining issues unless this court has any questions. Here, the district court committed structural error when it closed the courtroom during jury selection, requiring automatic reversal and a new trial. I believe the facts are largely undisputed, as the facts outlined in both of the parties' briefs are the same. In short, the district court ordered the public from jury selection out of the courtroom. Starting with the first issue of whether structural errors need to be preserved, let's begin with well-settled U.S. Supreme Court case law.
I'm sorry to interrupt you so quickly, Ms. Portomeo, but if we could step back and one of you, if you would address the question of whether this is structural error at all. I recognize that there's plenty of case law that says denial of a public trial is structural error. We have kind of a partial closing of the courtroom. So I'm curious of your view of that, and where is the line? Is any closure of the courtroom for any moment in time structural error regardless?
Well, first, I guess you refer to partial closure, and the Attorney General also refers to partial closure in her briefs. So I'm not really sure how this is a partial closure. This is a complete closure, as my position is, just as in Presley was a complete closure. It doesn't matter if it's just one part of the trial. If the public is completely excluded, then that's a full closure.
I probably used a bad terminology. So a complete closure of any portion of the trial, your view is structural error?
Correct, yes. And a lot of U.S. Supreme Court cases and Colorado Supreme Court cases and Colorado Court of Appeals cases cite Waller versus Georgia for the position that closing the public or forbidding the public from being part of the trial is structural error. And so I think that's pretty well settled, and the Attorney General does not dispute that in her brief. Would you like me to go on?
Continue with that. Okay. Thank you.
So in 1984, Waller says that a Sixth Amendment right to public trial is identified as a structural error. We have U.S. versus Gonzalez-Lopez, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2006, reaffirming that position. And it's applied as structural error in Presley versus Georgia in 2010. So the second U.S. Supreme Court case law I want to talk about is structural errors trigger automatic reversal. And that comes from Sullivan versus Louisiana, and that's well recognized by our state Supreme Court as well. And again, I think the parties agree on both of these points. At least they do in the briefs. So if structural error requires automatic reversal, then an objection need not be lodged. This is the only logical conclusion that can be reached. This position is supported by countless cases from the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as the Colorado Supreme Court, that explain that structural errors are not amenable to harm analyses.
Okay, let's just make sure I understand you on this. So do I understand you to be arguing that if it's structural error, it cannot be waived by the defendant?
Well, so the AG uses waiver in a couple different contexts in her brief, appellate claim, waiver of the objection, waiver of structural error. If you would like me to, I can go through all of those, but essentially my position is that you can't waive the right to public trial without a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver, and at a minimum, it has to be knowing.
Okay, so just to stay on this point for a moment longer. In Peretz, the United States Supreme Court cited its prior decision in Levine for the proposition that failure to object to closing of the courtroom is the waiver of a right to a public trial. Do you read anything in Presley as stepping back from that statement or disavowing that prior case law?
No, I think Presley is in a completely different context than Levine. Levine is about the due process right to public trial, not the Sixth Amendment right to public trial. Plus, Levine was in the context of a contempt proceeding during grand jury proceedings, and as we know, grand jury proceedings are secret. So there's a lot of distinctions there, and I believe also... I apologize. I'm getting the pieces a little confused, Peretz versus Levine, but so I think that's completely distinguishable. And Levine was predated Waller and Press Enterprise, which clearly laid out this four-factor test that was then reaffirmed and reapplied in Georgia, or Presley versus Georgia in 2010. So I think the law is very well settled in the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think the U.S. Supreme Court, in fact, was kind of irritated and showed that in Presley, that the Georgia Supreme Court was still not following their four-factor test.
Would you take the position then for the same reasons that Anderson is no longer good law?
Yes, exactly. It predates, it's from 1971, it predates Waller and Press Enterprise. And otherwise, it's very similar to this case. No objection, they said it was waived. And it was during jury selection as well. But that predates Waller and the Supreme Court, and it predates, for frankly, decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court saying that this is a fundamental right, and then also recognizing that it's structural error. So we have a situation where the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, was recognizing that this right was far more important and critical to a fair trial than simply what the Colorado Supreme Court did in Anderson.
So, and I apologize for keep interrupting you, but these issues are difficult.
Yeah.
I guess a couple additional questions. What do you do with Johnson, U.S. versus Johnson, which basically the Supreme Court said structural errors can be waived and suggesting amenable to plain error analysis? I mean, you've kind of said to us, waiver, end of story. Even Presley seems to suggest there's a violation of the public right to trial absent an effort to go through the factors in Waller, which suggests it's not as cut and dried as you're saying. Just you're suggesting to us, once we find the violation, end of story, reverse. I'm not sure it's that simple. Waller seems to suggest you have to do some sort of inquiry at least, and then Johnson, in cases like it, suggests we look at plain error.
I'm sorry, are you saying Johnson?
Yeah, I believe that's the U.S. Supreme Court case, the one that said even structural errors are amenable to plain error analysis.
Okay, I'm not familiar with Johnson, so I apologize on that. But so.
And you wouldn't even know this, Ms. Portimer. We've had a couple of cases on this issue recently, and that I may be taking it from another case, and I apologize to you.
Okay, so the way I look at structural errors and standards of reversal, structural error in terms of standard reversal and standards of review and all that, is so in Chapman versus California, we departed from the law that all constitutional errors required automatic reversal. So there was this rule that constitutional errors required automatic reversal, and then in Chapman they kind of started cutting away at that. They said not all constitutional errors require automatic reversal, and we're going to carve out specific ones that do require automatic reversal, and that's structural error. And then these other constitutional errors that we deem not quite as important, as not as fundamental as the structural error constitutional errors, those ones are amenable to harm analysis, and we're going to conduct that. So by separating those out, it's just logical that the only thing that's left, if this is deemed a structural error, then automatic reversal applies. And I understand the hesitancy with the waiver, and so maybe what we need to be doing is, if we're going to say that you can waive your right to a public trial in Colorado, then it has to be at least knowingly, and I would argue knowingly, intelligent, and voluntary. And here, the record's silent. Defense counsel said nothing and defendant said nothing, presumably because defendant didn't know that he had a right to a public trial.
And on what authority are you relying for the principle that the waiver of a public trial right in this circumstance has to be knowing and intelligent?
Okay, so, well, first off, there are some jurisdictions that say that the right to public trial is a personal right to the defendant and that it needs to be waived knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily. So the authority on this is all over the board.
Have you cited any in your brief?
I do not cite that in my brief, but I came across it during my research, and I understand, so that's why I'm not citing it to you. If you would like me to tell you the case and give the AG an opportunity to rebut that, I'd be happy to, but...
It's true.
Okay. So the case that says that is Commonwealth versus Lavoie, Lavoie, and it's a Massachusetts Appeals Court case from 2011. And the site is 954 Northeastern 2nd, 547.
Sorry, what was the page again?
Oh,
547 or so.
547 is the generic site, but the pinpoint...
That's...
Okay. additionally, in Waller, I believe, let me just make sure I'm not misleading you. In Waller, there's a footnote that says that this has to be knowingly. This waiver must, I'm sorry, I may be getting this a little confused. Waller footnote 6, it says on page 47 that one of the reasons authored in advance for closing a trial, avoiding tainting of the jury by pretrial publicity, is largely absent when a defendant makes an informed decision to object. Informed akin to knowledge, knowledgeable. The defendant needs to know this before he can object to this fundamental right.
So is it your position any time that a court would consider, for instance, with space limitations, excluding the public, that the court has to give an advisement to the defendant?
Well, I think that's up to you, the Court of Appeals and the Colorado Supreme Court, quite frankly. But I mean, my position would be that it needs to be a colloquy similar to like a Curtis advisement and a knowing, intelligent, voluntary. I mean, this is not going to be a really hard advisement, just do you understand you have a right to a public trial? Yes or no, kind of thing. Do you waive that right? I think that would satisfy both the knowing, intelligent, voluntary, or just simply knowingly. Alternatively, we just need some affirmative action or statement from the defendant that he understands he has this right.
Well, let me go a different way here. Could, what if the court did what kind of Presley or Waller suggest here to say, you know, letting everybody know that there's not enough room in the courtroom here for all of the folks just and the panel to sit, so we're going to have to exclude the courtroom, and the court made a finding. Would that be enough?
I think that the Supreme Court's very clear in Waller that they want, and Presley, that they want all four factors analyzed.
Sure. So say the court made, so I guess one question, is a possible remedy here to send this case back, is the issue that the court didn't make findings, because the court could have made these various findings. Is that really what we're dealing with here?
I think we both, the parties agree that no remand is required here, and in fact, one's not necessary, because Waller and Press Enterprise clearly create a presumption of openness. If that presumption is not rebutted by the court making, following the Waller four factors, then that presumption of openness has not been rebutted. It survives, and it's unconstitutional to close the courtroom. If you don't mind, I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
2 minutes and 45 seconds.
May it please the court? My name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. The defendant's conviction should be affirmed because he waived his right first to appellate review and second to a public trial. Now, with respect to waiving his right to a appellate review, the Maryland Court of Appeals in Robinson versus State discussed that even errors such as the, they were specifically discussing public trial, but even errors which may implicate structural error must still be preserved for appellate review and can be waived. Now, the crux of this case is essentially whether structural error can be waived. So we'll move on from the appellate review question to whether, in fact, the defendant's right to a public trial can be waived. And the people contend that it absolutely can. Now, we agree essentially with the pyramid classification of the nature of constitutional rights. At the bottom, we have those constitutional rights which can be reviewed for constitutional harmless error. We move up the pyramid to those rights that can be reviewed for structural error. And finally, at the top of that pyramid is a narrow band of rights, which are non-waivable rights, absent a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver.
An example?
Certainly. Your Honor, the right to testify is a personal knowing requirement. A defendant must be given a Curtis advisement before he can waive the right to testify. The right to counsel. We interpret the Arguello advisement as something that defendant must be given before he can waive his right to counsel. Additionally, the right to a jury trial is a personal waiver that the defendant must waive, as well as the right to have the state meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, so essentially the right to accept a plea.
So what evidence do you have in this case that Mr. Stackhouse knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived his right to a public trial?
First and foremost, that's not required for the waiver of a public trial. I agree that in this case he did not execute a verbal waiver, but it is not required for the waiver of a public trial. Public trial has never been interpreted by our Supreme Court or by the United States Supreme Court as within that narrow band of rights that requires such a waiver. This is a fundamental right, yet not all fundamental rights give rise to that waiver. And this is a right that I think it's further implemented that it can be subordinated to the defendant's right to a fair trial. We don't see that when we look to the right to counsel, the right to testify. These are rights that can't be subordinated to the right to a fair trial.
Let me ask you a question. The examples you've given require a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver, which requires an advisement before that waiver. Can you give any examples of where there can be a waiver without such an advisement?
Yes, Your Honor, and actually if we look to the same constitutional sections that give us the right to a public trial, that gives us guidance, both under Colorado Constitution, Article 2, Section 16, and under the Sixth Amendment. We see the right to a speedy trial as well as the right to venue, and these are all part of the rights. The right to a speedy public trial by an impartial jury of the county or district in which the offense is alleged to have been committed. Venue can be waived, and it can be waived by failure to object. That's exactly the same situation that we're looking at here. Now, if we look to even Waller and Presley, which first of all do not dictate reversal here because they both specifically deal with objected to closure, but if we look to both of those rights, we see that if the court considers this four-factor test, they can close the courtroom. They don't need the defendant to agree to it. Now, under the four-factor test, we can't deprive the defendant of his right to testify. That's a personal choice of the defendant. These are distinguishable rights that cannot be grouped into the same category. This is a constitutional right, but it is not within that narrow band of rights, and this is a right that can and was waived here.
It's interesting that you're grouping these rights together under the Sixth Amendment, the ones that you say can be waived merely by failure to object. You said the right to a speedy trial, the right to venue, and the like. Are you aware of any case law that has recognized the similarity of public trial rights, speedy trial rights, and the like?
No, Your Honor. I did extensive research to try to determine whether there is a case out of any jurisdiction that has compared these. Public trial cases overall are fairly limited in the context of cases. I agree with counsel that there are certainly some cases, some jurisdictions that have found it to be a right that requires a knowing and voluntary waiver. That is limited. And if we look specific, but there is no case that I'm aware of that has grouped these or analyzed this in this context. If we look to the Maryland Court of Appeals analysis in Robinson versus State, that gives us a good framework for looking at this case here as to the type of rights that can be waived, and specifically discussing it in the context of rights which implicate structural error and public trial. In Robinson, the Maryland Court of Appeals goes through and discusses various cases collecting the waiver of a public trial. One of those is Levine versus United States, which was discussed. And in that case, they find that the grand jury proceedings were closed. They moved into a contempt proceeding after the grand jury proceedings. And there, the failure to ask for the courtroom to be opened during the grand jury proceedings was a waiver of that right. Similarly, Maryland references cases out of the Fifth Circuit, out of the Second Circuit, the Third Circuit, and our Supreme Court in Anderson also cites to that same case out of the Third Circuit, which is U.S. versus Sorrentino, that rejecting the argument that counsel's waiver doesn't bind the defendant, further suggesting that this is not the type of right that requires a personal, knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver by the defendant. This is, in fact, a right that can be waived by counsel and by counsel's inaction. Further, if we look to our Supreme Court's decision in Anderson, there the defendant failed to object and the court found that it was a waiver. The dissent in Anderson disagreed with the majority's conclusion, noting that there was nothing in the record to indicate that the defendant or his counsel knew that the courtroom was being closed. It was simply the bailiff's procedure. And in fact, the record indicated that counsel did not have any knowledge of that closure. The dissent says, well, you can't waive it if you don't know about it. Yet here, even under the dissent's analysis, and certainly under the majority analysis, the defendant and counsel were aware of that closure. We have it clear in open court where the court says, I'm going to be closing the procedures. There's opportunity for the defendant to create a record there for counsel to object. None is made. Now, if we look to Presley, we see some of the other ways that a defendant and defense counsel can make a record on this to in part enable appellate review, and also demonstrate what alternatives may have been possible, which would further demonstrate there had not been a waiver. And there, in Pressley, they make several post-trial motions going through all of the options that would have been available to the court. Here, we don't have an objection. We don't have a mid-trial motion. We don't have a post-trial motion. We have nothing indicating that the defendant ever objected to closure, that it wasn't merely a strategic decision. We look at the type of case involved here, and it's certainly personal voir dire that you may not always want people involved in.
Isn't this the problem that we're dealing with? You know, Waller addresses factors the court should look at, and it's a bit concerning to me, frankly, whether we have enough. I recognize you both say we shouldn't have a remand, but I'm not sure we have enough to say. I mean, what you're saying is the defendant, he didn't do this, he didn't do that. If I remember, I may be mixing up my own cases here. There was at least a question whether he knew this happened, and again, if I'm mixing that up, I apologize to both of you. You know, don't we need the court to make some fact findings here as to whether, you know, what, even on a waiver analysis, what the defendant knew and when he knew it?
Your Honor, the defendant was aware of this closure, just as a point that the defendant was present in the courtroom at the time that the court closed the proceedings. Yet, if the court does determine that it's necessary to determine whether the defendant waived his rights or also whether the court considered the appropriate remedies, a remand could be possible in this case. We contend that it's not necessary because the waiver is clear from the record, but if the court feels additional findings are necessary, then a remand could be appropriate in this case. Now, we believe it's not required in this case because the record demonstrates that the defendant had the opportunity. He was aware of the closure, counsel was aware of the closure, and they chose not to object. Now, in addressing the court's question earlier as to whether this is a complete closure, that's arguable in this case. Now, our record doesn't tell us exactly how long the courtroom doors were closed. We don't know if they were locked, and we don't know if the public actually even abided by that record. We have no idea because no record was made. We do know that there was extensive individual voir dire in this case, which the defendant did not contest and does not challenge on appeal due to the sensitive subject matter of this case. And now, this also goes back to whether this is a right that can be waived. In talking about, we've recognized that particularly in sexual assault cases, individual voir dire may be necessary in order to give the defendant the right to an impartial jury, the right to have the jurors able to discuss freely and openly what their biases may be in this type of case. And that's what we're looking at with that portion of the voir dire. Now, the portion that we believe was closed is approximately 20 minutes per side. So that's what the court limited the parties to, and from the best we can tell from the record, that is the portion of the proceedings that was closed.
Regardless of where we go on this waiver issue, could you address briefly an argument that defense counsel made for the first time in her reply brief, namely that this could be analyzed under the plain error standard of review?
Your Honor, I don't know that this has ever been looked at under the plain error standard of review, but if it was, we would argue that this was not a series where there was a clear error shown by the court of knowing and settled law, particularly given that waiver is something that has been addressed by other courts, and also because it has been long recognized that the defendant's right to a public trial can be subordinated to his right to a fair trial. We'd also argue that if you go into the harm analysis, then we also have to consider the strategic decisions that can be made by counsel and whether that's implicated here. Now, certainly that is a possibility. Our record isn't clear as to whether this was a strategic decision, though it rarely is when strategic decisions are implicated. We know that this is a child sex assault case. We know that the victim started as a four-year-old little girl who was in the who the defendant was helping to raise. There may have been questions that counsel chose to ask outside the presence of the defendant's family. We don't know. But if we go to a plain error analysis, a harm analysis is certainly appropriate in that case.
But how could that be? How could you ever have, I mean, we'd get to plain error analysis by first finding structural error, as Ms. Portomero argues. How could a structural error ever not be plain just by definition?
Yeah, in that case, I think we'd have to look to whether this was a complete closure, and we'd go back to that portion of it. Now, under this, that would have to assume, of course, that there is error at all, which the people contend there is not. Where there is waiver, there is no error. Therefore, you don't need to look at whether this was structural. You don't need to look to whether this was plain. Because when a defendant waives his right to any number of constitutional provisions, there is no error. Just as when a defendant waives his right to counsel, just as when a defendant waives his right to venue.
Is it really that there is an error, and I don't mean to play games with language here, is it that there is no error, or this defendant doesn't have the right to come into a court and say this was error? I mean, yeah. To me, this is kind of two different things.
Yeah, and I think it goes to both. I think if we look to whether there is error, it's whether the defendant waived his right to a public trial, because you can give up constitutional rights, and we argue that's what happened here. If it's whether this defendant can raise this issue here, that's waiving his right to appellate review by failure to preserve, which those are our two separate arguments for waiver, and they're both implicated in this case.
Let me ask you something about the nature of the right that we're talking about, because we keep referring to it as defendant's right to a public trial. Now, isn't the right to public trial not only defendant's right, but the public's right? And how is that distinguishable?
Yes, Your Honor, the public does have a qualified right to attend criminal proceedings. But as we see in the Supreme Court's decision in Press Enterprise, the public has a remedy, which is long been recognized by our courts as well. That's to file a civil action. The public does not have standing in the defendant's case, and that does not have standing to reverse his convictions. Now, Presley gave us an example where a defendant makes a record as to exactly which member of the public was excluded. That uncle in the Presley case did not file a civil action. He could have. Press Enterprise is an example where the public, in this case the press, did file a civil action seeking to have the proceedings of voir dire opened up. That would have been a remedy here for any member of the public, any member of the press that had been excluded. But that is not grounds to reverse the defendant's conviction, because that right belongs to the public, and the public does not have standing in this case. Now, I agree that the First and Sixth Amendments have generally been read together in the context of a public trial, yet they are distinguishable in terms of standing and in terms of remedy. And that's an important distinction here. The defendant has waived his right to appellate review, and he has also waived his right to a public trial.
Can I ask you, Ms. Grant, I know you've got just a few seconds left. You keep talking about waiver, and I'm a little bit hung up on it. Isn't there a distinction between waiver and forfeiture? I mean, waiver, it seems to me, has always been defined as a voluntary relinquishment of a known right. There are cases, including the U.S. Supreme Court, that talk about a forfeiture just being not raising an issue you should have raised. Why is this a waiver as opposed to a forfeiture?
Your Honor, I think that Levine out of the U.S. Supreme Court case tells us that this is actually a waiver. We also have Anderson out of our Supreme Court telling us that this is a waiver. I think it could be read as a forfeiture, but both our Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court have interpreted this type of failure to object as a waiver. And thus, the people respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
And Ms. Grundy, before you sit down, I know that opposing counsel had cited to a case, and I don't know if you were familiar with that case. And if you would like, within 3 business days, if you want to write a letter to this division only, just responding to that case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Well, I'd first like to address the AG's argument that speedy and venue aren't analogizing public right to the speedy and venue rights, but neither the speedy right nor the venue right are considered fundamental, and that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that this is a fundamental right. Additionally, those rights are not considered structural error, rights implicated by the structural error context. So, because although there is no U.S. Supreme Court decision that says that the right to public trial falls within that narrow band of rights that needs a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver, it's analogous to all the other cases that are identified by the U.S. Supreme Court as being in that narrow band of rights. And there's additionally no U.S. Supreme Court case that says it is not within that narrow band of rights that requires knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. So there's an absence of information at this point. I'd like to address the AG's argument about standing. No case that I'm aware of says that the public's right to a public trial can be waived by the defendant, and it's not cannot be asserted by the defendant for that matter. And in fact, I would argue this is analogous to the situation in Batson, where a juror does not necessarily a juror that's being discriminated against can be their rights can be vindicated by the defendant.
Are you aware of any defendant's conviction that's been reversed based on the violation of the public's right to a public trial?
I believe in Press Enterprises, they reversed for, they didn't give a new trial. They just reversed for, it was a suppression, oh no, it was, excuse me, it was voir dire. I apologize. And I apologize. I don't remember the outcome in Press Enterprises, but Press Enterprises would give you the answer to that. And Press Enterprises actually deals with individual voir dire and says that it's not, they have to do the Waller test, the Press Enterprise test. And it's okay in this instance, they said, because the individual jurors were initiating the request to do the voir dire individually. And then the transcripts needed to be provided in a quick manner to the public. I want to really emphasize that there is a presumption of openness both in Press Enterprises and Waller, and it's discussed at length in Press Enterprises. And so that is where the remand is not required. The burden is on the court because the court is the protector of all the rights here. The court needs to make these findings, and if there's not enough findings made, then that presumption of openness has not been rebutted, and that is why you need a new trial at that point. I see that my time is up, and I ask you to reverse Mr. Stackhouse's convictions and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, before we go, Ms. Grundy, if you do not wish to file a letter, do you need to file a letter regarding that one case?
Your Honor, I take the opportunity to do so.
All right. All right, thank you. All right, the case will stand submitted and the opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much.